There, everyone. Lovely to have you here this morning. Now, David Sheath is my name, if you haven't met me before. Now, there was a bricklayer who suffered a major accident on a building site, and in his report to his insurance company, he wrote down poor planning as the cause of the accident. Now, the insurance company naturally wanted more information than that, so they requested more information, and he wrote back this letter that I'll read out to you. Dear sir, I am a bricklayer by trade. On the day of the accident, I was working alone on the roof of a new six-storey building. When I completed my work, I found I had some bricks left over, which when weighed later were found to be 150 kilograms. Rather than carry the bricks down by hand, I decided to lower them in a barrel by using a pulley which was attached to the side of the building. Securing the rope at ground level, I went up to the roof, swung the barrel out, and loaded the bricks onto it. Then I went down, untied the rope, holding it tightly to ensure a slow descent of the 150 kilos of bricks. You will note on the accident reporting form that my weight is 80 kilograms. Due to my surprise at being jerked off the ground so suddenly, I lost my presence of mind and forgot to let go of the rope. Needless to say, I proceeded at a rapid rate up the side of the building. In the vicinity of the third floor, I met the barrel, which was now proceeding downward at an equally impressive speed. This explains the fractured skull, minor abrasions and the broken collarbone, as listed in Section 3 Accident Reporting Form. Slowed only slightly, I continued my rapid ascent, not stopping until the fingers in my right hand were two knuckles deep into the pulley, which I mentioned in paragraph 2 of this correspondence. Fortunately, by this time, I had regained my presence of mind and was able to hold tightly onto the rope, in spite of the excruciating pain I was now beginning to experience. At approximately the same time, however, the barrel of bricks hit the ground and the bottom fell out of the barrel. Now devoid of the weight of the bricks, the barrel weighed approximately 20 kilograms. I refer you again to my own weight. As you might imagine, I began a rapid descent down the side of the building, and in the vicinity of the third floor, I met the barrel coming up. This accounts for the two fractured ankles, broken tooth, and severe lacerations of my legs and lower body. Here, my luck began to change slightly. The encounter with the barrel seemed to slow me enough to lessen my injuries when I fell into the pile of bricks, and fortunately, only three vertebrae were cracked. I'm sorry to report, however, as I lay there on the pile of bricks in pain, unable to move, and watching the empty barrel six stories above me, I again lost my composure and presence of mind and let go of the rope. And I lay there watching the barrel, empty barrel, and its journey back onto me. So there you go. You've got to feel sorry for that guy. But in some ways, that can be a picture of our lives. I don't know about you, but instead of coming to God for help, what we can do is we can think, I'm okay on my own, I can handle this, I'm going to do this my way. And we take things into our own hands, and pretty soon it can feel like our lives is just running from one crisis to another. And sometimes it's not until we hit rock bottom that we come to realise we desperately need God's help. Now, I know many of you here can relate to that. Many of you have told me your stories of running from one crisis to another before you've hit rock bottom. Margaret shared her story last week of how it was once God had taken everything away from her that she was willing to put her pride on the shelf and put her trust in Him and turn to Him. And in a sense, what we've been doing, this is the third week of this Celebrate Recovery series. And what we're wanting to do is sort of, we're wanting to say to you, if you feel like you're at a point in your life where you've hit rock bottom, God wants to help you. And God is able to help you recover. But I also want to say for all the rest of us out there who haven't yet hit rock bottom, this recovery series is a good wake-up to turn to God now before we go through too much more pain, so that we don't have to hit rock bottom before we throw ourselves on God for His help. Now, you'll see the eight steps of recovery is listed in your outlines, and it's based on the eight letters of the word recovery. We've done steps 1 and 2 in the last couple of weeks. 2 weeks ago we looked at the reality step. And that is, admit it. You've got a problem. We try to play God, but we keep stuffing it up. We can't do it. On our own, our life is unmanageable. And last week we looked at the hope step. That's the E in recovery. I might be powerless, but God has the power to help me. And God wants to help me because he loves me. And today we come to the commitment step. That's the C in recovery. Consciously choose to commit all my life and will to Christ's care and control. Consciously choose to commit all my life and will to Christ's care and control. Now, when you read the gospel accounts in the Bible, that's Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, the biographies of Jesus, you see Jesus is a man who is totally worthy of us committing ourselves to him completely. He is worthy of us handing our lives over to him and his care and control. What we see when we look at Jesus is a man who displayed love and power in everything he did. So we see it so often with sick people who come across Jesus, the blind, the lame, lepers, deaf people. And Jesus always has great compassion on them and he heals them completely. His friend Lazarus was dead and Jesus came to his side and wept tears of grief. But then Jesus brought him back to life. He not only had love, but he also had the power to reverse broken lives. When Jesus' friends were caught on a boat in a furious storm, they cried out to him for help. And he stood up and just with a word, he was able to silence the storm, to stop the storm, to stop the raging waters. And we saw that same love and power in the death and resurrection of Jesus. The fact that here was the greatest man who ever lived, the only sinless man to have ever lived, and yet he laid down his life as a criminal when he died on the cross for us. He did it to pay for our sins. Such was his love for us. And when he rose up again from the grave, it demonstrated that God's power was at work in him, raising him up to be the king of the universe forever. See, Jesus demonstrated his love and power in everything he did. Here is a man that you can completely trust yourself to. He has the power to help you, and he has the love and compassion to care for you, whatever your situation. And Jesus calls on us to commit ourselves to him completely. So listen to Luke chapter 9, verse 23. Part of this is in your outlines. Luke chapter 9, verse 23. If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me will save it. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world and yet forfeit his very self, his very soul? Now, a Christian is someone who follows Jesus. And Jesus spells out very clearly the cost of that commitment, what it means to follow him. Following Jesus means I stop making the rules myself. Jesus now directs my life. I deny myself. I take up my cross. Now, back in Jesus' day, Jesus' listeners would have known what that meant. You take up your cross, it means you're on your way to death. It means you're on your way to execution. Your life is over. You no longer have any more rights, no future. You cop the ridicule, the taunts of the crowd. To take up your cross and follow Jesus is to say, Jesus is my king. I no longer live for myself. Now I live for him and him alone. Now, deciding to follow Jesus is a lot like the Copernican Revolution. And I want to explain what I mean by that. Before this guy Nicholas Copernicus came along in the 1400s, people used to think that that the earth was at the centre of the universe. So here we go. We've got a picture. The earth there is at the centre, and it's a very technical diagram, this. See that? All the planets revolve around the earth. Even the sun was revolving around the earth. And that's the way, that's just the traditional way that people thought about the universe. It was a very earth-centred view of the universe. But Copernicus came along and suggested something incredibly radical. He suggested that, no, the sun, we ought to see the sun at the centre of the universe. It was such a radical mind shift that it took over 100 years to catch on. Can we have a picture? There we go. So the idea was that the sun is at the centre and all the planets, including the earth, actually revolve around the sun. And as I say, it took over 100 years for people to grasp onto this because it was such a massive mind shift. It was something that was just almost too difficult to grasp hold of. Now, that is sort of the mind shift that is required in becoming a Christian. See, the natural way to live is we think, my life is all about me. And everything in my life revolves around me. Even Jesus, I might slot him into orbit in my around me, but it all revolves around me. And the mind shift is, we've got to say, no, Jesus is at the centre. He's at the centre of everything. The universe, in a sense, revolves around him, including my life. And that's the sort of radical change of mindset that needs to take place to become a Christian. Almost 20 years ago, I was a leader on a scripture camp. So it was a camp for sort of older high school kids, and most of them would have called themselves Christians. And one night we put this question to these kids on the camp. We asked them, can you be Christian and still do what you want? What would you say if you had to answer that? Can you be Christian and still do what you want? I wonder what answer you would have got. What we did, we set up a debate and we had a secret ballot. Everyone got to give their honest answer, and then we split up this group of 50 kids according to yes and no. Quite an extraordinary debate. Of the 50 kids, they all said yes, except two. So 48 of the 50 said yes. You can be a Christian and still do whatever you want. And then, you know, we conducted a debate, and the people who said no won hands down. And as that debate continued on, the 48 who said yes desperately tried to support their position, but they were fighting a losing battle, certainly from the Bible. You see, they had somehow developed a me-centred view of Jesus. Jesus was like an optional extra in their lives. Jesus was like a planet revolving in orbit around them. You can choose to have Jesus or you can choose not to. But it's a completely inadequate view of following Jesus. It's an inadequate view of that revolution that takes place when we put Jesus at the centre, not ourselves. Now, Jesus makes these extraordinary demands on those who would follow him, that unless we deny ourselves, take up our cross, we cannot follow him. It's the commitment that Jesus calls on us to take, but we know that he's worthy to give that commitment to. We know from his love and power that we can commit ourselves to him completely, to his care and control. So I want to think about this question. Why don't we commit to Christ? What is it that holds people back from giving themselves to Jesus completely, from making him the centre of our lives? Now, pride is a big one. Margaret reminded us of this last week. But the idea is, I like being boss of my life. I make the rules, and I'm not going to let anyone else tell me what I have to do. Now, if that's you, what you need to do is go back to step one, the reality step. You need to get a grip on reality. We like to play God, but you're not God. And sooner or later, that realization that you can't pull it off is going to come crashing down on you. Sometimes God uses pain and suffering in our lives like a smoke alarm to sort of wake us up to the reality. But let me say, don't let it get to that point. Don't go through any more pain and suffering than you have to. Wake up to reality now and turn to God for help. But I want to say there are lots of people who have come to grips with reality. They know that Jesus is their only hope, but they still hold back because of fear. And I think fear strikes in a couple of ways. Firstly, there's the thought of, I'm afraid I might miss out. I'm afraid that somehow I might miss out. I'm afraid of what I might have to give up if I follow Jesus. Now, there's all sorts of things that people are afraid they're going to have to give up. There's all sorts of things that people cherish so much. It could be a relationship. It could be a certain lifestyle. It could be an ambition or a habit or a possession. I don't know what it is. But I imagine for each of us, there is something that's very cherished that we just would hate to have to give up. And so the thought of giving ourselves completely to Jesus means, well, I might have to give that thing up that I so treasure. Now, Jesus helps us put this in perspective. He says, what good is it for a man to gain the whole world and yet lose or forfeit his soul? Very helpful, isn't it? Whatever it is that you cherish so much, you can't take it with you beyond the grave. And Jesus is saying it doesn't stack up to eternal life. You just can't compare it. Whatever it is, it's just not worth putting Jesus aside for. It really all comes down to an issue of trust. And that is, do you believe Jesus wants the best for you? Do you believe that Jesus wants the best for you? And if you do, then trust him. Commit yourself to him. It's like the guy who falls off a cliff, and halfway down he grabs onto a branch, and he's stuck in this terrible predicament. You know, 100 metres, you know, up, 100 metres down, sheer cliff face, and he calls out, help me, somebody, I need help. And he hears a voice, this is Jesus, trust me, let go of the branch. And the guy looks down, the 100 metre drop below him, he looks back up, is there anybody else up there? Now, it can be scary committing to Jesus, because there's that sense of, what am I getting myself into? It means I'm entrusting myself to Jesus' care and control. And he may call on me to make changes in my life that I don't want to make. Jesus might call on me to deal with stuff that I'm trying to avoid or ignore. Stuff that I just don't want to have to confront. And for many of us, that can be very scary. But you can trust him. Jesus will only do what is in your best interest. Listen to these reassuring words from Matthew 11. This is what Jesus said. He said, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. See, even though it's scary committing your life to Jesus, you can trust him and he will never let you down. Now, there's another fear that people have, and that is, I'm worried I can't follow through. I'm afraid that I might start following Jesus and I might start strong, but then I might give up down the track. And there are so many things in life like this, aren't there? So, like, you know, I often decide, you know, it's time for me to get fit. So what I'm going to do is 6 o'clock each morning, I'm going to go for a run around the lake. And this might last for a couple of months, very rarely, might last for a couple of days. And then there's a cold morning and I sleep in or I catch a cold or whatever. And all my good intentions for getting fit just fly out the window. Now, we do it all the time. New Year's resolutions. Some people have just given up on New Year's resolutions because it's just they just know they're not going to be able to pull it off. Weight loss or giving up a habit like smoking. We start with good intentions, but after a while they just fade away and we just go back to our old habits. And some of us are afraid to commit to Jesus because we don't think that we can follow through. We don't trust ourselves that we're going to be able to follow through on that commitment. We're just not good enough to maintain that level of commitment to Jesus. Now, I want to say, if that's what you're thinking, if you're thinking, I just might not be able to follow through, I reckon that's pretty healthy thinking. Because it means you're in touch with reality. It means you're sort of in touch with just your own weakness. The starting point of the Christian life is the recognition that you can't do it on your own. You need Jesus to help. And Jesus doesn't just help us start the Christian life. He helps us every step along the way. Jesus makes us this promise, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. Now, there's an old hymn, Amazing Grace, and most of us would know that hymn a little bit, I imagine. Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. Now, God's grace is his undeserved kindness. It's the way he just pours out his love on me, even though I don't deserve it. And that verse is saying that it's God's grace that brings me into relationship with God. It gives me a start in the Christian life. But a few verses later in this song, it says this, through many dangers, toils and snares, I have already come. It is grace has brought me safe this far, and grace will lead me home. And the wonderful thing about that is that it shows that we don't just start the Christian life by God's grace. Every step along the way in the Christian life is taken by God's grace. We don't start by grace and continue on with our own efforts. We start by grace and continue to trust in God's goodness and his work in our lives day after day. The Christian life is hard work. It's like a marathon. We make a commitment to follow Jesus, and that commitment means every day I take up my cross and I follow Jesus. Some days I stumble, some days I fall, but through God's grace, I get up again and keep going. Listen to Hebrews chapter 12. Stephanie read this out for us a bit earlier. The writer says, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Let's fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. See, as we run this race of following Jesus, we can get tangled up in sin. We can stumble, we can fall, and sometimes we feel like we've failed, and we're just best to give up. But God says, keep at it. There is forgiveness. There is a fresh start day after day. And we shouldn't focus on ourselves and our own inadequacies and our own failures. What God wants us to do is fix our eyes on Jesus. He's the one that's gone before us, and he's the one who will help us complete the race. We don't do it on our own. He is with us every step of the way. Now, through this recovery series, we've been hearing from other people who are on this journey of following Jesus. We've heard something of their struggle, something of their recovery. And this morning, Renee is going to come up and share his story with us. So why don't we welcome Renee up front. Thanks, Renee.
Sorry, good morning, everyone. I'm very nervous. Very hard to do what I'm doing. It's going to start first. For everyone else that's been here, it's been very traumatic. Celebrate Recovery has helped me to start to believe that I matter to God. I've always been someone that believed in God, believed that God was there, but he really had it in for me. I struggle with, you know, that I don't matter to him. I still struggle with that on a day-to-day basis. I've had a lot of hurts in my life that I found very easy to blame everyone else for, including God. To start with, growing up at the age of 12, my father left us. In those days, there was no pension for a number of months, anything else. Mum had four sons to look after, so we relied on the Smith family and Salvation Army and all that for, you know, survival. I found that a very hard time in my life. I actually went to work after school, weekends, anything to try and make something. In that time, I took on, at the age of 12, delivering home deliveries and that for a chemist. I was molested by that chemist. I was also molested by a school teacher, which made me, for the rest of my life, or for a long time in my life, believe that there was something wrong with me, not with anyone else, but it was me, that, you know, I stood out. I must have been a homosexual. I must have been this, everything else. That was one part of my life, so I became a loner. I didn't have friends, went through my school years with no friends, spoke to no one. Had criminal records, minor things, but things that I did that I'm not happy about. At the age of 18, I finally met a woman in a sly grog shop. I drank a lot from the age of about 15 onwards. We started a relationship. She had two children. I thought my life was changing. For 7 years, we remained together. At the end of that 7 years, I came home from work one day and she said, look, I've met someone else. I think I want to call it quits. Once again, the blame was her fault. It was everyone else's fault. God really had it in for me. Became very, very depressed. Tried to commit suicide. The only thing I had in my favour was I had one really, really good friend who didn't care what I'd done in my life, never interested in asking. He was always there to support me. When I was down, he'd be down there dragging me out, taking me out somewhere, to even the detriment to his own family, where his wife had asked him not to go, and he said, look, don't make me decide. He said, Renee needs me at this time. He said, I'm going. He said, if you don't like that, he said, well, that'll be it. He died at the age of 43. Once again, God's fault. I went through a period, 10 years, where I didn't work, or I worked very minimal, did nothing, had no nothing in my life that I was looking forward to. I shared a house with another man for 5 years who happened to be my present wife's ex-husband, and that's where I met my present wife. I finally asked her to marry me. Didn't expect that she was ever going to say yes, but very surprised she did, because I had nothing. I was penniless, had nothing, worked 2 days a week just to survive, to buy cigarettes, drink and whatever else. That changed my life once again. We got married. The church we went to, we sat down. The minister there said, well, look, you know, just put in an envelope whatever you can afford. We had the church service. And at the end of the service, she actually gave us back the money. We went on our honeymoon. I had a friend who was a manager at the bank. He okayed a $2,000 MasterCard for me at the time just to go on a honeymoon for a weekend. Back to work on Monday. I struggled then trying to do things. Robin had a home and everything else, and I've squandered that over the years. I've always blamed in the last 4 years, Robin and I have had a lot of problems, a lot of ups and downs. Very easy to sit back and I've blamed Robin for everything, including God, but mainly Robin. I've blamed her for everything I've ever, in the last few years. Going to recovery last year, Robin talked me into coming to church here. We came down, sat down. I liked what I saw, but I wasn't going to come back. Bernie happened to catch me, and Bernie talked to me, and Bernie said, "Look, why don't you come to recovery?" And I, "No, sorry, that's not for me." But Robin and a few others said to me, "Look, you should go and just have a look at what it's all about." So I went down to recovery. I thought, "Well, I'll just go down, go to one or two meetings, and then I can say, well, that's not for me, I can go." Very easy. Give up on everything. The people at recovery really helped me to sit back. They all sat around. We talked about our problems, and I was very lucky because they all listened to me telling them that Robin was my problem. That went on for probably a month or two. So I finally started to realise that the problem was me, not everyone else. Never believed God really cared for me or anything. I know God's always been there in my life. Every time I've travelled down the wrong path, somewhere along the line he's pushed me back, even though it was only temporary, but he's pushed me back each time. Recovery has helped me now to... it hasn't fixed my problems at home fully. It's helped me to accept that, I've got to accept blame for myself. I've got to start to change things. It may be too late. Robin may never forgive me for what I've done, but... I now find that I've got a group of friends within recovery, people that don't care what I've done in my past. They're there. And I haven't kept much to my script. Bernie's told me to stick to the script 100%. The one passage that I did read in the Bible, and this is only probably a month or so ago, that I try to stick to now, 2 Peter verses 1 to 11, if you read that. Also, I was saying to Bernie last week, we went to Foster for a weekend, and on a billboard outside the Uniting Church up there was a big billboard there saying, today is the tomorrow you worried about yesterday. So in other words, tomorrow isn't going to be as bad as what we all think. So hopefully it'll improve from there. Thank you very much for listening.
Thanks very much, Renee. As Renee says, now the difference now for him is that he is working on these things with Jesus' help. He's not doing it alone, and there's a long journey to go, but in God's strength, with Jesus' help, he's now working through a lot of these things from the past. Now, I want to finish this morning by inviting each of you to make a commitment to Jesus. Now, this may have been something you've done before, and that's fine, but it's there in your outlines, and just have a look at what it says in your outlines. Today I... blank, blank, so you've got to fill in the details. Today I consciously choose to commit all my life and will to Christ's care and control. Now, I want you to think, is that something that you can fill in? Can you put your own name in there? So I'll put David Sheath. Can you put your own name in? Now, 15 years ago, I made a commitment to Ruth, my wife. And I married her. I said, I, David, in the presence of God, take you, Ruth, to be my wife, to have and to hold from this day forward, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, to love and to cherish as long as we both shall live. This is my solemn vow and promise. And so you see, I've remembered it off by heart. Now, I made that commitment once. I made that commitment once, but it's a commitment that has implications for every day of my life. I didn't know exactly what that commitment would entail. Marriage throws up a lot of surprises, and I think Ruth's had far more surprises than I've had to deal with. But 15 years ago, I wrote a blank check to Ruth. And I wrote that I will love and cherish you, Ruth, for the woman you are today and for whatever woman you will become in the years ahead. And sometimes I haven't been loving to Ruth. Maybe even often I haven't been loving to Ruth. Now that doesn't stop me being married, but I need to stop and say sorry and keep working at keeping the promise I made that day. Now committing to Christ is a lot like that. It's a lot like getting married. It's like writing a blank check out to Jesus. Whatever the future holds, you are my Lord, and I commit my life to your care and control. Sometimes we're going to mess up. Sometimes we'll go our own way. And at that point, we need to stop and come back and say sorry and press on from there. So what I want to do is I want to add two things to this commitment. The first is, please forgive me when I fail. Now, it's not forgive me if I fail, it's forgive me when I fail. It's inevitable that we're going to mess up. I'm not perfect. I need Christ's forgiveness every single day of my life. And I also want to add, please help me persevere. And that's because I don't trust myself to keep this commitment to Jesus. I mustn't just lie down and say, oh, I can't do it, and be content with that. I need Jesus to help me get up and keep following him in the long haul. So that's what I want to do is invite each of you to make this commitment to Christ this morning. Now, many of you have made this commitment before, and it's like marriage. This is a commitment that you make once, but it has implications for every day of your life. And it may be that when you became a Christian, you didn't quite grasp onto what it meant. Maybe you still had that idea that Jesus was somehow in orbit around you and sort of slot him into your life. And maybe over time you've realised that committing to Jesus means he's at the centre. But this is a commitment that you make once and then you live out the implications for the rest of your life. And for you, this morning is like a remarriage ceremony, a commitment to the promises you've already made. But there'll be some of us who are making this commitment for the first time. So I want you to just pause and take a moment to put your name in there on that sheet. And I want you to think, are you prepared to pray with me as I pray a prayer? This is what I'm going to pray. Dear Jesus, today I commit all my life and will to your care and control. Please forgive me when I fail. Please help me to persevere. Now, just take a moment to pause and reflect. And if you want to pray that prayer with me, I'll pray it out loud in just a little while. But why don't you take a moment to reflect for yourself?